We actually got such great opening remarks that I'm going to pretty much just move into the first question for discussion. And I know we've also already solicited some feedback on this topic, but just to regroup and to get everybody back on the same page, the first question for discussion is, are there any structural or cultural impediments to audit committees obtaining the information they need to fulfill their responsibilities to oversee the work of the auditor? In other words, a lot of you have told us you've seen improvements and that you have very, very good audit committees that ask the right questions. But just to address comments we've gotten in the past about communications being boilerplate or audit committees not getting everything they need, is there anything standing in the way of them asking for things they need? Wayne?
In focusing on the question, I look at the word information they need. So we're talking about what's on the plate of the audit committee chair and the audit committee in obtaining information from the auditor. And it's really up to the audit committee chair, to set the ground rules for how to get that information. One of the things that was said, and I agree with, the extent that management is not participating in the discussions with the audit committee and the auditor, I think that does promote more robust, more in-depth conversations. So I think that should be one of the ground rules. It's a ground rule that is set by the audit committee, though, and not something that could be set in a standard. And I do believe that the kinds of communications, the more the communications are less formal, and I say less formal, I think that written communications tend to slow down the process or create the boilerplate issues to the extent they arise. So I think to the extent that you've got more verbal communications and, you know, two-way street, calling up the audit committee chair, calling up the audit partner, having one-on-one conversations, I think those are the kinds of things that promote the kinds of discussions that we're looking for.
I'd like to just jump in. In connection with this question, we've really teed up this question in response to some of the feedback we had at the SAG meeting last October when we were talking about our standard-setting priorities, and there were several members that talked to, you know, really encouraged us to add this discussion on. And there were several different members, some of them, their terms expired last year, some of them are still on the SAG, that indicated that the audit committees aren't getting the information they need from auditors. And so we're really trying to understand why that is. Is it a cultural thing? Is it that auditors are saying, I'm sorry, I'm not going to provide that information to you? Are they asking these questions but finding they're hitting walls trying to get a response back? Kind of what's going on here among different audit committees? Or we're trying to get a better sense of that question. So hopefully that'll help. I think, Joe Corselli, you were next.
Yeah, let me try to directly respond to this as you asked, Jennifer. I do think there is an issue there. I think there's still a number of public companies where, although the audit committee is empowered on to 301 to hire, compensate, and evaluate the external auditor, the CEO and the CFO still have, in some companies at least, disproportionate influence. And I think in many cases there's a reluctance on the part of the auditor to communicate too far beyond what the CEO and the CFO might be comfortable with. And so then, you know, what should drive that? I think what should drive that is audit committees being proactive. And I think what Jamie and Peggy and Lynn said was superb, very good, and I took a lot of notes from what they said. But I think what they largely said would be helpful with the overwhelming majority of companies that want to do the right thing. But regulators, in many cases, their responsibility is to deal with the small percentage of companies that are going to do the wrong thing. And I will tell you, as you well know, particularly the folks at the SEC, if you make a mistake, that's what the press picks up on. That's what the public picks up on. They don't pick up on all your successes. So when you look at this, let me give you some specifics about audit committees. Unlike auditors who are now heavily regulated by you, And unlike issuers who have historically been heavily regulated by the SEC, there's pretty substantial evidence that audit committees are not subject to the same level of outside discipline and enforcement. And let me give you two specific pieces of evidence. There's a paper in the European Financial Management Journal co-authored by Bernie Black, who's a colleague, who was a colleague for many years of Henry Hu, who has now got quite a high-level position at the SEC. And I'll just quote very briefly from this. Much has been said recently about the risky legal environment in which outside directors of public companies operate, especially in the U.S., but increasingly elsewhere as well. Our research on outside director liability suggests that directors' fears are largely unjustified. The bottom line, outside directors of public companies face a very low risk of out-of-pocket liability. So in terms of private securities litigation, very low risk. What about regulators or the market for director services? Is the labor market effective? And so there's a paper in 2007 in the Academy of Management Journal by James Westfall of the University of Michigan and Iffy Stern at Northwestern, and they study the likelihood that directors of U.S. corporations will receive additional board appointments. Directors increase their chances of board appointments via provision of advice and information to CEOs in ingratiation behavior toward peer directors. Directors also increase their appointment chances by engaging in low levels of monitoring and control behavior. So to the extent that these studies are even somewhat accurate, I don't think this is really primarily a PCAOB issue. I think this is primarily an SEC issue, because to the extent there's any government body that has regulatory authority over board members and audit committee members, it's the SEC. The last thing I want to say is a lot of focus on audit committees, and I'm working on a project right now with two other researchers, as well as Ovana Palmrose, four of us, and many of you know Ovana from her days at the SEC. And we look at restatements, material restatements, over a reasonable length of time, and we look at audit committees. And there's pretty extensive research that good audit committees improve the quality of financial reporting. It's reasonably robust research. And one of the premises of our study was, if I'm a top management team and I don't really want oversight, and now I'm forced by the SEC and exchanges to have oversight, I can easily drive around that. The way I'll drive around that is I'll put my college roommate, I'll put my golfing buddy, I'll put my social network friends on the board and on the audit committee, which are not explicitly prohibited by the exchange listing rules. And so what we look at is we have audit committees and we break them into two buckets. One bucket is audit committees where there is less management involvement in selecting board members, and the other bucket is where there's more management involvement in selecting board members. And in the bucket where there's less management involvement, the audit committee is effective in reducing the risk of restatement. In the bucket where there's more management involvement in selecting board members, the audit committee is completely ineffective. So I think one of the things that, and this may be related to potential standard setting, is that auditors should closely look at, and I imagine the major firms do this, and hopefully other firms as well, is to look at how do people get on the board and what are the social links in addition to economic links between board members and senior management.
Thank you, Joe. Jim Schnur?
Thank you. Just a couple of comments. One, in listening to this morning's discussion before the break, I took away, you know, the impression that actually the objective of the standard around communication had not only been achieved but have gone beyond the requirements. It sounded to me like, and through my own experience, that audit committees get the information they want. I agree with the comments around the chairman and the audit committee clearly set the tone for what information they want. But I'm not aware of any situation, even through inspection, where there has been any concern expressed about the level of communication. I'm struggling a little bit with, in terms of the debate. It sounds like the standards, methods, objectives. I'm not sure who is it that is saying that communications are not being made. A couple of other points around documentation. I don't think that adding documentation will improve the communications. I think that's contrary. I think Lynn said this morning, one of the things he said this morning was, in terms of getting the frank discussion, he went to great lengths to get one-on-one with, in an executive session, with the audit partner, and he got the communications and the dialogue that he wanted. So I just, from my own experience again, if the firm has to put something in writing, they seriously consider, being careful about what words are chosen in that written communication. And the best dialogue is clearly informal dialogue.
Thank you, Jim. Randy?
Jennifer, you mentioned this has come up many times before the October meeting, and I've heard the discussion today. I think an awful lot of issues seem to be commingled with these discussion questions around audit committee communications. My sense has been that there has been a real improvement. I won't dispute what Joe says, that I'm sure there is some variation among performance among different audit committees. But to me, there has been a lot of improvement over the last few years. Capturing those best practices, whether it's this body or someone, ought to do that. I think all the firms have networks of audit committee chairs or members that we engage with. And frankly, we have not heard audit committee members that we're dealing with saying we're not getting what we need. We'd like to think we are proactively taking them what we think they need, and they're satisfied with that. But certainly if they think there's something more they need, as you heard in some of Lynn's discussion, and they say this is what we want, I can't imagine us saying, no, we're not going to go give you that kind of information unless it's something that's very unusual. So I just sense there's an awful lot of things swirling around here in terms of what's the problem we're trying to solve. I guess I would say, well, there are certainly people here in the preparer role, certainly those who served on audit committees, giving you their experiences. I guess I would say we ought to be able to reach out, this body or somebody else, and find out, do audit committees think they're getting what they need? And if they are, then maybe that says we're trying to solve a problem that doesn't really exist.
Thank you, Randy. Larry Salva.
Thanks. My recent experience with audit committees is limited to the company that I currently work for. Obviously, I had experience with audit committees when I practiced in public accounting. But at least currently, I could say that there are no cultural or structural impediments to our audit committee obtaining all the information that they need. And I've heard the concern that audit committees' performance can stand improvements at other companies, but I have to say that that's all, hearsay for myself, at least anecdotal. And I may have been one of those members at the October meeting that said maybe there's a role for the PCAOB to do something that could influence better performance of audit committees receiving communications or engaging in dialogue, perhaps by prodding the auditors to have more required communications or to focus on that area. But I think I've come to realize that that's probably not the right way to go. It's not a problem. There's no impediment in the audit committee getting their information. It's the question of how to get those audit committees that haven't embraced best practices or don't have the kind of the lead directors, understanding how an audit committee really should function effectively to embrace better practices. And perhaps it's not the PCAOB. I think I agree with Joe that this isn't a solution to be provided by the PCAOB. If anything, it's probably more the SEC. But I'm not sure I'd agree necessarily with Joe's tact of dealing with the selection of board members as much as one idea that I had was in the same way that Corp Fin specified the objectives of the comp committee's report on compensation and how they're trying to achieve, you know, compensation discussion and analysis, if they were to specify the objective of the audit committee report, which most people have acknowledged is fairly boilerplate and meets the minimum requirements that are specified in SX, if it were to, if the objective were stated as give a discussion of the substantive areas of focus and activities of the committee throughout the year and overseeing the audit process, perhaps that would tease out a kind of a less boilerplate discussion of exactly what the audit committee engaged in. And the ones that are using best practices would have a very different look to their audit committee report than those that actually just did the minimum.
Thank you. Greg Jonas?
At Moody's, increasingly, when a company ran into financial reporting problems, we would ask to speak with the audit committee chair to try to gauge to what extent the audit committee was providing independent oversight of the resolution of the issue and remediation procedures. And kind of surprisingly to me, increasingly, audit committee chairs would be willing to talk to us. And obviously this was in a very stressful environment. So the fact that increasingly they were willing to do this over the 7 or so years I was at Moody's suggests to me that the environment, in fact, did improve. Many of those discussions with the audit committee chairs were exactly of the tone and substance that you would like. The committee chair was very knowledgeable of the issues. The committee chair spoke personally about what they were doing to oversee the problem, and you got a lot of comfort that that there was substantive oversight. But there were times, and not just a few, when you would ask a question of the audit committee chair and the CFO would speak, or the chief counsel would speak, and sometimes the outside expert conducting the investigation would speak, but the audit committee chair wouldn't speak. And it just reminds me of my own experience with audit committees as an audit partner, that the times where trouble arose, where you didn't get the candid communication, is when somebody thought they should be the gatekeeper between the auditor and the audit committee chair. And I think there's a lot in the literature already that speaks about the importance of the auditor developing a direct professional relationship with the audit committee chair, the client-type relationship that they would have with the CFO and the CEO. And I don't know that we need any additional guidance, but I do believe that in those cases where we are not getting kind of candid communication going, I suspect it's because the audit committee chair and the audit partner do not have the kind of relationship that would be desirable. So if there were something to do in this area, in response to question one, my instinct tells me to emphasize again that where somebody thinks they're a gatekeeper or tries to play a gatekeeper role, the audit partner has to have the strength of will to circumvent that behavior and establish that direct personal relationship, even if someone in the company doesn't want it to happen.
Thank you. Paul Beswick?
I'll deal with the elephant in the room and show that I'm actually paying attention. I think there's been a lot of good feedback, and you know, as I sit here and listen, I mean, I think there are some things that PCAOB may want to consider in standard setting about communications and about, you know, evaluating the effectiveness of audit committees. But it's pretty clear the number of people around the room have some views about, you know, whether it's, as Joe phrased, the regulation of audit committees or whether it's just what audit committees are communicating to the public, as Larry suggested. So what I can commit to this group is to at least take the feedback back to the commission and share it to the appropriate people and talk about what we're hearing and, you know, what are some things that we could do to help address some of the concerns that are being addressed by the people around this. Joe, I'd be very interested in the research that you've cited, so I think you've already got my email address. If you could send it on to me, that'd be helpful. So,
thank you. Liz Gantner?
Hi, thank you. From a smaller audit firm perspective, Some of what Joe mentioned earlier I think is very relevant in that, and Greg, you too, that typically the audit committee or the board has a much closer relationship to management, has a longer history, whatever. And so therefore, there really does end up being this concept of gatekeeper. I can tell you I've actually attended an audit committee meeting where absolutely everything that I said, the acting CFO rephrased, reinterpreted, and then explained to the guy sitting across the table from me as if I was not speaking English in some form or fashion. And so I fully appreciate that that is a very big issue in at least the types of or size of public companies that I might be dealing with. And I think that there needs to be some re-emphasis by the SEC of the role that the audit committee is going to play and the auditor in relation to that. And I sort of liken it to a dance where neither party knows who's in the lead, who's taking the lead. And so if an audit committee chairman says they're not getting the information that they need, I would just go, why aren't you asking for it? And invariably, they don't know what it is that they need, and so they're not asking. But they have a sense that perhaps they're not being communicated to in some intelligent way. So I guess the auditors need to understand that where the audit committee is on the so-so scale as opposed to the great scale, that the auditor needs to assist and educate them into the role they're supposed to play, eliminate the gatekeeper scenario, and provide them the types of information that they should be looking for and suggest pieces of information that they should be tracking themselves. So, but at the end of this, I would say, without any question, over the last several years, I have seen rather dramatic improvement in small company audit committees and particular attention to having a financial expert and someone who could go toe-to-toe with an auditor about accounting and auditing-related issues. So, thank you.
Thank you, Warren and Melquist.
I admit that I'm one of, or confess to being one of those gatekeepers, right? Because for a couple of, again, large companies, in my position as the head of internal audit, I've been responsible for helping the audit committee chairs set the agenda and making sure to the extent I can, which I will go to great lengths to do, to make sure that the audit committee can fulfill their responsibilities and they have the proper information from management, from the external auditors, and whoever else is having to present before the audit committee. In regards to this specific question here about are there structural or cultural impediments to them getting this information that they need, I'd say yes, there are. Okay, from my experience and experience of colleagues that I've talked to, and it's basically. The tone in the company and the culture in the company has a lot to do with it, and the strength of the CFOs and the CEOs and who's attending the meeting, and how visible people are and how visible the decision-making processes are within the company, that actually helps the audit committee get comfortable with their responsibility. The structural issue is more not along the lines of who's reporting to who or who doesn't. Although there have been improvements in that in recent years because the external auditors now are fully responsible to the audit committee in all respects, or should. But we have different rulemaking bodies affecting the various parties who are in the audit committee meetings. So there are standards for the various parties to provide the information to the audit committee, whether it's internal audit, whether it's external audit, whether it's management. And it is up to somebody within the company to help the audit committee actually understand that they have a need for this information and what questions to ask, pretty much what Elizabeth just said. And so I'm reminded of what the Canadian Institute of Chartered Accountants did, and they provided pamphlets or brochures in terms of what types of questions should an audit director or a board member ask of various constituencies within a company, so that their responsibilities were fulfilled. I think something like that would be very helpful, keeping it apart from best practice type of information. But the question is, from a structural standpoint, then who has the responsibility to do that? Because the external auditor has requirements to give information to the audit committee. Something has to exist for the audit committee to know that they should receive that, and what do they do with it, and what types of questions should they ask, such so that their responsibilities are really fulfilled and they are carrying out their mission. And I think that's an issue that needs to be considered, to be looked at.
Thank you. We can move on to the next question. I think we've already gotten some feedback on this. I guess things that I've heard is that we've had differing views on oral communications versus whether to require more written communications. We've discussed the gatekeeper issue and the need to have the audit partner ensure there's direct communication with the chair. But before we move on, is there anything, any other specific input anyone has on how to address not having boilerplate communications or communications that aren't robust enough? Doug Anderson.
I just wanted to comment. I think having boilerplate communications is a part of the nature of the beast. When you give a specific directive and a standard, the auditor will come up with boilerplate language to make sure they exactly meet that specific language. And the more the standards are more generic in nature and talk about objectives as opposed to specific comments about independence or something else, you can hopefully try to avoid the boilerplate. But the more we get specific standards, I think just the more boilerplate you're going to have, and there's nothing you can do about that, because that's the defensive nature of an auditor to be able to prove that they exactly met that very specific standard.
Peggy Fran?
I second that, and I am not convinced that it's boilerplate. I've been to too many places where it's been different. I think you see similar formats from firm to firm, But I've seen a lot of differences. So I do agree, if you have a standard, you're going to have a template and you're going to have a model, and it's more likely to be boilerplate unless there's different information that has to be included.
From what I'm hearing from a number of you, it's the written communications may in fact be boilerplate because it's compliance with the requirements to communicate A, B, C, D, and E, but that doesn't inhibit an effective dialogue nonetheless, substantive dialogue about the risks and the issues. I think that's the message that I've heard from Peggy and Doug in those comments and from some others. And some heads nodding. Thank you, Larry.
I guess I'd like to interject too. There's been a lot of discussion about recognition that the PCAOB doesn't control the universe regarding audit committees, that the SEC has a role in governance. So we're limited to what we can, what we can tell the auditor to do in connection with the communications. So in that, our purview is the auditing standard and providing direction to the auditor. I've heard some very good things that auditors are providing now to audit committees. Is there something more we could include in our standard to kind of encourage that robust discussion, the relationship, the dialogue that might be helpful for maybe, recognizing there's some audit committees that are excellent and are really engaged and asking a lot of questions, have a great relationship to the auditor, whereas I've heard, some described as that relationship might be so-so.
Okay, I'm going to go to the next question, but again, I think we've actually gotten some valuable input on this already. So let me just maybe repeat what I've heard today, which is, what should the board consider including in the auditing standard to encourage more effective, robust auditor communication? And again, I think I heard things like including an objective for the communication and being more principles-based. Is there any other specific feedback on this question before we go to the next topic for discussion? Joe?
Real short, on like my last comment. If communication between the auditor and the audit committee is weak and ineffective, that at least may suggest that the audit committee itself may be weak and ineffective, and that should be reflected in the control environment. And again, based on what I've done with fraud, I think in the 99 study, 83% of all frauds involved the CEO and or the CFO. In the most recent study, although this may seem hard to believe given that you're close to 100% already, that number's gone up. So essentially, guys, if there's fraud, top management's involved, at least if it's fraud large enough to get the enforcement division's attention at the Securities and Exchange Commission. So if there's not effective communication between the auditor and the audit committee, that should be reflected in the control environment, because that reflects clearly on the tone at the top and the culture inside the organization. So I hope the board is looking at that during the inspection process.
Thank you, Joe. Greg Jonas?
In my experience, there are two techniques that I'm particularly fond of, both of which are already in the governance literature, but I don't know that they're in the auditing literature, both of which I think audit partners can help with, and so it might be appropriate to include this in the auditing literature. One is the notion of upfront agreement with the audit committee, between the auditor and the audit committee, of exactly what the nature of the dialogue will be over the course of a year, and when it will occur. In other words, planning. If a lot of times audit committees and auditors, I think, particularly in the past, would kind of show up to a meeting, neither one knowing exactly what the plan would be. But having the upfront dialogue about expectations and how to meet them, I think, fosters a good type of discussion that's in the public interest. The second technique is an annual evaluation of the audit committee of the auditor, and conversely, the auditor's evaluation of the audit committee. In other words, they sit down and they talk about how they can improve each other's performance. I think that also helps drive the type of dialogue that we long for in this discussion.
Thank you. Jamie Miller?
Yeah, and to echo Greg's comments, and I think this builds off our discussion before, I think if you looked at AU 380 and really looked at the upfront planning and on the back end, the evaluation component, and these may be subtle changes, but changing words from inform the committee to discuss and agree the nature of the dialogue and the expectations with the committee, you know, those can be very substantive in terms of driving a different interpretation. You know, and at the back end, you know, from the auditor evaluating to the auditor must discuss with the audit committee and agree upon an evaluation, you know, those types of things I think could potentially help as well.
Oh, Liz?
One might argue that we do have an evaluation of them, and that's vis-a-vis a significant deficiency letter or material weakness letter. So, you know, back to Joe's point about if it rises to the level that it's ineffective and they're not doing what they're supposed to do, then we do have an evaluation of them.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on to our next discussion topic, which is enhancing the existing requirements related to communicating management's judgments and estimates. As you've focused on yesterday afternoon and again this morning, judgments and estimates are very important these days, especially as financial reporting frameworks provide for an increasing number of fair value measurements and as we reflect on the events of the recent financial crisis. The existing standard currently requires that the auditor ensure the audit committee is informed about management's process for formulating particularly sensitive accounting estimates and about the basis for the auditor's conclusions regarding the reasonableness of these estimates. This brings us to our next question, which deals with whether or not the board should enhance the auditor's required communications in this area. So the first question on this topic is, should the required communication regarding management's judgments and estimates be enhanced to report additional information on the judgments and estimates? And if so, what information would be useful to the audit committees? Greg Jonas?
One of my favorite topics.
Were the SEC to act on the CFIR committee recommendation on the judgment framework, and were the board to incorporate those outstanding ideas into the audit literature, it would then be a natural follow-on to incorporate those ideas into the discussion between the auditor and the client, and in particular the audit committee. Of the 12 ideas in the judgment framework, my three favorites, and there are three favorites because I think they are the ones that are typically not often done, are the following. Discussions about judgments, it's easy to focus on what was decided and why. But the essence of the discussion should be on what could have been picked that gave a very different answer but was not, and why. So it's the notion of what were the waterfront of alternatives, reasonably possible alternatives that were considered, and why did you reject them? And then when you justify to the audit committee why a certain estimate was picked within the range of alternatives, the essence of that discussion should be to reconcile the pick to third-party views and data. It's easy to be introspective about all this stuff. We picked it because of the following internally focused reasons. The challenge is to focus it on we picked it because of the following third-party views or data, and in particular, investor interests in data. So we picked it because it best displays the economics of the transactions to investors. Here's why. That discussion is rare and is, in my book, the key of the 12 elements in the judgment framework.
Thank you. Joe Cartello?
This question doesn't specifically ask about other communications that might be helpful to audit committees. So if you'd allow me, let me just throw some other things out to consider. And again, I'm torn as to whether you put this in a standard or, I'd like to think auditors and audit committees are doing this. But just some things to think about that I think would be helpful. Status of management efforts related to remedying material weaknesses, significant deficiencies, and management letter comments. I chair an audit committee of a not-for-profit, nothing like the major public companies in this room, but we've had material weaknesses, and so we try to follow up on that. I think that's important. An evaluation of the CEO, CFO, chief accounting officer, internal auditor, as it relates to their competence and objectivity. I think the external auditor is in a good position to have an opinion on that. Observations regarding other disclosures. Keep in mind, as an audit committee member, I'm still a board member, so I'm signing the 10-K. So, and the external auditor has to read the whole 10-K. So what about the disclosures in the MD&A? What about the disclosures in the CD&A? They probably have an opinion on that. The disclosures elsewhere in the 10-K, I hope they read the proxy statement. I hope they read press releases, particularly about earnings releases. So what do the disclosures in that look like? Observations regarding risk management. I mean, that's arguably why our economy has imploded. And that is, at least on the New York Stock Exchange, a charge to the audit committee. And so what's the external auditor's opinion on that? And then observations regarding compensation plans and the incentives that they create. There's an extensive literature that incentives, management incentives, can create perverse behavioral consequences as it relates to financial reporting. And again, I would think that a bright auditor would have some opinion on that, and that as an audit committee member, I'd at least like to hear their opinion.
Thank you, Joe. Kurt Schott.
Thank you. I was just going to mention, and Jamie alluded to this a little bit earlier, but if you look at your page 5 of your briefing to us, and I think it lists the 10 or so elements of your standard 380, I was struck by the difference in the language of the two that I think are the most significant there, significant accounting policies and management judgments and accounting estimates, and it says you should determine that the audit committee is informed, and you go through the rest of the standards, and it says the auditor should inform. I'm just curious as to why that should be different, and in the spirit of questions 4 and 5, it seems to me that they should be all the same, that the auditor should inform.
Okay, thank you. I mean, I guess I'd let Jennifer comment as well, but it's my understanding there might be some slight difference in the language as they weren't developed. Those 2 points you mentioned in particular weren't developed at the same point in time. And I think in some respects it's the emphasis that management should be communicating to some extent these discussions.
I don't think I can have that much to add. I mean, we adopted the standard from the AICPA, and I wasn't involved in all the deliberations that went into AU 380 or the amendments that have been made to it. But, you know, as part of our process, we are looking at the standard in its entirety and what should the language be, what's going to be the best to drive the communication. So, you know, hearing a preference toward some language versus others. Jamie had some, I thought, some good suggestions as well regarding some of the language. That's what we're interested in hearing, that feedback.
Quickly then, I mean, what's to ensure that management has actually informed on these issues and that the audit committee actually understands some of the, you know, the material decisions made, that this sort of, you wanted some check and balance on management's ability to choose policies, and if that's not communicated well to the audit committee and we're simply thinking that the management has communicated that to the audit committee, I'm not sure that, you know, that's where investors want that to reside, that there should be an interesting check and balance on that, and that the auditor ought to be informing the audit committee of what they observed in these particular areas. And it's great that they've already been informed by the management, but I think it's also incumbent upon the audit committee to hear what the auditor thinks about those.
I see Randy's card up, way up or down, and Wayne, be interested in hearing some of the auditor's perspective on how you view this language and their communication requirement.
I'm waffling here, obviously. I was not on the auditing standards board, so I'm not sure I can decode exactly what drove it. I take it to mean that, again, the financial reporting process includes management and auditors and the audit committee, and unlike most of these other bullets, it would be pretty normal that management might inform the audit committee about how it accounts for significant accounting estimates, but the role of the auditor to make sure that they did so, they were certain that it took place, and I would think in practice would amplify or add to and share views. So I don't think it was to limit auditor communication, but I think it was just to reflect that that's a natural topic for management to also discuss with the audit committee, as opposed to others that particularly talk about the auditor's view on something. So I guess, you know, that's certainly something you could clarify or make sure both of those took place, or only require the auditor to do it in your standard. But I guess I would just, I mean, it makes sense to me that if you're talking about a company's accounting and financial reporting, that you also want the company's accountants involved in that discussion. I think that's all it means. I don't think there's anything more to it. Someone could go back to the auditing standards board and check, I think.
See, Wayne and Galen both have their cards up, so I don't know if you want to respond to this or something else. Yes, go ahead, Wayne.
Yeah, there are several items in that listing that use different language. You know, some discuss, and some of the items where it says discuss, it's almost boilerplate in terms of the responsibility for other information. That is truly almost a boilerplate, and it says discuss. So I'm not sure the language means anything in terms of the difference. I would assume any one of these could engender a discussion versus just a one-way communication. And there was one area that is in the ISA that could probably be built into this when it comes to accounting management judgments and accounting estimates. And some of it may be subsumed in the one about quality in terms of being in the rough on either edge, and that's the possible indicators of management's bias in terms of developing the estimates. And if the auditor thinks that that might be here, that's kind of like the scorecard that Lynn had mentioned before, or the gauge as to whether it's to the left or to the right. But again, that may be subsumed in the quality of the entity's accounting principles or the application of the accounting principles also.
Galen?
Yeah, my preference would be more the discussion than the informing, although two-way street, and certainly that feedback needs to be there. In terms of the list, we already require a discussion of independence. I think it could be a little bit more specific, partner rotation. I think firm tenure should be on that list as well. How long has that firm been doing that audit? Auditor judgments about accounting principles, critical policies and practices in the financial statements as well as the annual report, the MD&A. Key performance indicators. I liked Lynn's idea of that matrix in the top five risk areas. Who is doing what? And I think these are things that the audit committee should be informed about, and the auditor should have that type of dialogue. I also believe that a discussion of the related parties, related party transactions, known related parties, site agreements, as well as subsequent events would be the types of things that I would hope to see in some sort of guidance that the auditor has.
Thank you very much, Galen. Doug Anderson?
Yeah, I just wanted to, on that page 5, when we have the various bullet points listed there, I think Wayne already addressed this in some way, but as you look at point 5 and it talks about really asking an auditor to comment on the quality of the accounting principles, and it doesn't describe very well what you mean by principles, it's just selection of it or application of it. But then you go back and you look at point number 3, and there it's kind of curious because it only asks the auditor to talk about the process that's being used, doesn't actually talk about the estimates themselves. And I think it would be a real upgrade to change 3, the third bullet, to read more like the 5th, and really apply that same thinking about the principles, apply that same thinking to the estimates that are used.
Thank you, Doug. Lynn Turner?
Back to what Kurt and Randy were thinking about. As I recall, the way this got in is the Blue Ribbon Panel on Audit Committees first went first and came up with their 10 recommendations. And I think this may have actually been one of their recommendations. Once they came up with their recommendations, then the SEC and the Auditing Standards Board went into rulemaking together. And the ASB picked off the rulemaking from an auditor perspective, and we picked off, OCA actually picked off the rulemaking from the audit committee perspective and drove the two pieces together so we got consistent answers. But it really came out of that, and there was one particular private meeting that I recall Chuck Bowser, who sat on some audit committees, talked about the need to really get down and understand these judgments and how could you, you know, at the time we're having troubles with restructuring reserves and people weren't understanding them. We had the cookie jars and all. And so it was, how could you really oversee an audit if you're not getting into that? So let's get the auditors to tell us what they really think about these type of judgments and these estimates and whether these reserves are right, and that's what really turned around and drove this. Peggy can correct me if I was wrong because she was involved with the process, but I think that's how it turned around and came about and what the discussions were like in those meetings. I personally think, as we again heard at the Treasury Committee from some of the investors, they would like this to go the next step and see further disclosure then from the audit committee out to investors about that conversation as well. So that would be their next step.
I just had one follow-up that I was interested if any of the auditors had any reaction to the listing that Joe Carcello put out. There were at least a couple of items there that well, I think several of them were very interesting. Some I wondered if you felt that it was within the scope of the auditor's responsibilities. I guess Joe talked about observations regarding risk management and laid on the table that some of the financial crisis is a result of poor risk management over position taking by financial institutions, et cetera. And maybe the auditor should comment on observations about risk management, observations about the competence of senior officers like the CEO. And I wondered if anybody had any reaction to that and how that fit in with the auditor's responsibilities regarding financial statements or internal controls over financial reporting. Wayne Collins.
I'll hail the easy one in terms of the competence of the CEO and other accounting people. We get asked that question all the time in executive session, so I don't think that's anything that we have a problem in responding to.
And Jim Schnurr?
Thanks, Marty. I understand, you know, the question and Wayne's point about we get the question all the time. I don't think it's something that should be a requirement. It's not necessarily in our area of expertise in terms of auditing the financial statements. So while we typically will respond to those types of questions, it's with the caveat that we're not experts in that area. And, you know, it's simply our observation based on doing the audit. But it's not, we talked about experts this morning and core competency. That's not our core competency in terms of evaluating. You know, we're not charged with evaluating, you know, whether the CEO or the CFO is doing a good job.
Sam Ranzillo.
I agree with Jim, and I thought some of Joe's list was overreaching. But it just, I guess as I listen to this conversation, it just seems to me there are places that I think the board can go to determine whether or not, indeed, there's a problem. There's the National Association of Corporate Directors. Almost every one of the larger firms has some form of an audit committee institute that's not just us and what we think, but audit committee members that get together and talk about being audit committee members. And it just seems to me that there's a wealth of information that we seem to be, and maybe I'm wrong, but most of what I'm hearing today is fairly anecdotal. Maybe some SAG members a year ago made a comment that there's a problem. I don't see the problem, but it just seems like to Joe's list, is that what an audit committee member, are they asking to see that and we're not providing it to them? I just think that there is a place that you can get some pretty good, rich information from corporate directors in a number of different forums, and then let's figure out if we indeed have a problem.
Good. Thanks for that input, Sam. Peggy Fran.
On that note, I suggest why don't you approach the NACD or another organization and ask them to do a survey, because you'll have some statistical information there. I think they cover several thousand board members and certainly a large number of audit committee members.
Thank you. If no one has anything else, let's go to our next question, which is somewhat specific, but we wanted to point out that the language in the current standard calls for the auditor to communicate or inform about the process in formulating particularly sensitive estimates. And our question to you was, should the requirements apply more broadly to all significant accounting estimates and judgments? Or in other words, what should be the trigger for this communication?
one of the comments I just heard from, I think the last comment was from Doug on this one. I think he was right on point, really, with this comment, saying this seemed to be a little limiting compared to some of the other required disclosures in terms of just inform about the process for formulating particularly sensitive accounting estimates. You thought that the language should be a little bit stronger, including such as judgments about the quality of the entity's accounting principles and things of that nature. So I gathered you were also thinking at this point here, five, when you made your comment a moment ago. Yes, thanks.
Jamie Miller? Just a couple of thoughts on this one. I agree with Doug's point on process versus a more holistic view of the estimate and potentially sensitivities. But I guess the other words I would focus on in this quote are the particularly sensitive accounting estimates language and, you know, the ability of the auditor to use judgment about what they should be discussing with the committee, as opposed to, you know, a more broad definition of significant accounting estimates and judgments, which, you know, frankly, in today's environment, with the complexity of the current accounting standards, with fair value becoming much, much more prevalent and potentially even more so, you know, arguably everything we do today involves significant judgment and significant estimates. So I do think if we're going to move to a more broad definition, we have to have a way for people to define what does significant mean and how should they view it in the context of this. You know, otherwise, I think you could get into a situation where, again, it becomes boilerplate because you're just, frankly, discussing everything. As opposed to what's important.
Thank you. Wayne Collin?
Yeah, one thing in considering this particular issue, just advise to look to the ISA 260 that does require communication on the auditor's views about significant qualitative aspects of the entity's accounting practices, including accounting policies, estimates, and disclosures. And uses, you know, significant is the word that's used there, so just in terms of the consistency approach.
Thank you. Sam Renzilla?
I agree with Jamie, and I think the words were chosen carefully back when that was drafted to avoid just every, I mean, if you think about significant accounting estimates, they're embedded in just about every number in the financial statements. And I think the words particularly sensitive were added to provide the auditor with some judgment to stay away from the, while still a significant accounting estimate, the more mundane aspects of those judgments and get to the stuff, you know, the way I would interpret particularly sensitive is, what's the highest risk of material misstatement to the financial statements, and what should the audit committee know about those accounting estimates? So I think if you change the words, just be sensitive to sort of the layering of and what you want to achieve with respect to the communication with the audit committee.
Thank you, Sam. Well, let's fit in at least one more question before lunch. I know we're running a little behind. Marty says we can get them all in, so.
No one's hungry, right?
Our next topic for discussion focuses on the increasing importance of disclosures to a reader's understanding of financial statements. The current disclosure requirements regarding fair value, variable interest entities, derivatives, and share-based compensation are extensive and complicated to compile, as well as critical to readers' understanding of the complexity and subjectivity of the related accounting measurements, as well as the risks associated with the related transactions and instruments. The current requirement for the auditor to communicate his or her view on the quality, not just the acceptability of the accounting principles, mentions that the discussion should include matters such as the clarity and completeness of the financial statements, which include financial disclosures. However, as the amount and complexity of disclosures increase, the board is determining whether or not to enhance the required communications to have specific requirements to discuss disclosures, which brings us to the next question.
Should the auditor be required to discuss his or her assessment of the quality of disclosures in the financial statements with the audit committee? That looked like a tie, so we'll go with Greg Jonas.
Yes.
Lynn Turner?
The footnotes are such an integral part of the financial statements today. I would question any audit committee member and auditor who didn't have that discussion. The Blue Ribbon panel recommended that auditors talk about the quality of the financial information, accounting policies and all. To exclude the footnotes would be like excluding one of the most significant portions. And if I, as an institutional investor, knew an auditor wasn't talking to the audit committee about that portion of the financial statements, quite frankly, I'd be stunned and wonder whether or not we need to go get another auditor or another audit committee member.
Wayne?
This is another one where I quoted the part from IAS A260 that is in the ISA also. So from a consistency standpoint, I would support that.
Seems to be pretty strong views about the... Ted White.
Yeah, equally strong. I would just say emphatically yes. As usual, Greg said it much shorter and better than Lynn, right?
Lynn, is your card still up, or just for the amen? There seems to be very strong views with respect to this issue regarding the importance of the auditor to discuss the quality of disclosures in the financial statements with the audit committee. We haven't heard any points to the contrary. Thanks, Bella. Jeff Mahoney?
I just wanted to agree with the others. As I mentioned earlier, particularly in the fair value measurements and the other areas that you mentioned, these having robust disclosures there are critical to investors. It mitigates some of the risks in connection with those estimates. It also helps investors assess the reliability of the reported of the amounts that are reported in the face of the financial statements, and helps them determine whether those amounts should be adjusted or ignored. So I add yes to the previous yeses.
Jamie?
You know, one thing as I think about this, while I think in principle the answer here is yes, I think we also have to be careful to give the auditors guidance as to exactly what quality means. And what I mean there is you could take a company and completely fill out a disclosure checklist and get all of the right answers but still not have quality disclosures. And I think it's really important because the real evaluation here is going to be qualitative as opposed to a check-the-box mentality. And so that may mean additional guidance. It also may mean that when the FASB completes its disclosure framework project, you know, there's some important linkages there that the PCOB can build on, but it may be that you want to wait until that time before you do it.
Thanks, Jamie. Well, with such strong consensus and enthusiasm around this point for the auditors to be involved in discussing the quality of the disclosures in the financial statements, I think this is a good opportunity for us to take a break around our enthusiasm for this issue. And as we get ready to wrap up the communications with audit committees when we get back from lunch. So thanks for the very constructive dialogue on that point. Lunch is served.